Thank you. The topic I was given, I guess, I didn't come up with it myself, this afternoon is Whatever Happened to Heaven, which happens to be the title of one of my books. So maybe that's where it came from. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have read Whatever Happened to Heaven? Not too many. Boy, we've got a lot of potential customers here. Except we don't have any copies of it. So you'll have to go to your bookstore or whatever. this was my next to last book, I think. I think it was published in 89, if I'm not mistaken. Well, I can't remember. Shortly before it was published, it was at the printer and in the process of being published, I noticed an article in the newspaper, and it was summarizing a talk that had been given by the chaplain of the U.S. Senate, Richard Halverson. And it sounded like he'd been reading my manuscript. And I was looking for a copy of that article, which I know I have somewhere around here, but oh, here we go. I just saw it as I flipped through. He had given this talk in Nashville, and it's quoting him now, quote, "The more I listen to evangelicals talk, the less I hear about the hope of Christ coming again, and the more I hear about making this United States a Christian nation, a prosperous nation. Sometimes I think if Christ would come back, it would constitute a terrible interruption of their plans." And that was what caused me to write the book. I had noticed quite a bit of a change in the thinking of Christians, not liberals, but evangelicals. We used to talk about heaven, you know. We used to talk about the rapture. People used to even believe in the rapture and expect it. If you could imagine that. You know, if I had some water, it would be a great help to me. I don't know if that's possible, to get a glass of water. But we used to even have bumper stickers, you remember? I don't know if you had them in Canada. We had them in the United States. "Ride at your own risk, I'm leaving in the rapture." You remember that? What? Have you? They've all worn out in California. Or down in the U.S., you don't see them anymore. People don't talk too much now. I'm speaking in general terms. I'm not speaking about present company necessarily. And we did sing about his coming. But in general terms, they sing about his coming at funerals. But you don't really hear too much about it. Part of it was due to a great disillusionment that came into the church. I remember when the late great Planet Earth first came out. In fact, I can remember Hal Lindsey. It was his first book. We were good friends. We've been friends for many years. And he used to speak at some meetings we had in our home in those days. And I can remember when he stood up in our living room to, oh, maybe 120 Jewish people. We used to have meetings for Jewish people and various other groups. And about 100 some Jewish people there that we'd had for a supper, and he held up the mock-up of the late great Planet Earth. And thank you very much. I certainly in those days never thought of writing a book, and I don't know how the thought entered his head. It was his first. A very popular book, sold, I think, what was it, 25 million copies, something like that. And I remember when the church was so excited with the thought of the soon return of Christ. And I used to say in those days, I don't think he's coming back. I do. You know, we should expect him, the imminent return of Christ. He could return this moment. But I can remember saying way back in those days, I don't think he's coming back yet. There are too many people talking about it. Too many people expecting him. And you remember one of the things Jesus said was in Matthew 24, he said, "At such an hour as you think not the Son of Man cometh. And then I began to see the pendulum swing from a pre-trib to a mid-trib to post-trib to all-mill to post-mill, you know. And then I began to think, well, praise God, he's going to come when they're not expecting him. Because I believe in a pre-trib rapture, which we don't have time to go into, probably, unless in the question and answer we'll try to get time for questions and answers. But part of the reason, the late great planet Earth was in fact part of the reason for the disillusionment that came. Now, Hal Lindsey did not intend it, but some people interpreted his book as saying that a generation was 40 years, and that the generation that saw the Jews back in their land would be the generation that would see the rapture. And so they added 40 to 48, gave him 1988. They subtracted 7 years Great Tribulation. So he had to return in 1981, which he didn't. And if you were a post-tribber, the tribulation didn't even begin in 81. So we had problems. Better readjust our thinking. Now, while I'm talking about that, let me make a suggestion. I think there's been a misinterpretation of that statement. We could look at it in Matthew 24. Matthew 24 and verse 34. Jesus said, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." Now there are those who are known as post-millennialists, reconstructionists. I don't know if these terms would be familiar to all of you. And they say this generation meant the generation to whom he was speaking. And therefore, within 40 years approximately, the supposed length of the biblical generation, and that's debatable in itself, but we can't get into that. But why, isn't it amazing? 40 years later, less than 40 years later, A.D. 70, Jerusalem was destroyed. So you see, it was fulfilled to that generation. And these people go so far as to say the entire Olivet Discourse, all of Matthew 24 and 25, and all of Revelation up through the middle of chapter 20, was fulfilled in A.D. 70. Nero was the Antichrist. Christ returned in the person of the Roman armies. Amazing. That was the wonderful promise. I will come again, you know. Behold, I come quickly. And isn't it great? He came in the person of the Roman armies to execute judgment upon Israel, to destroy Jerusalem. It's amazing that anybody could believe that, but a growing numbers of people do believe it. And, you can see quite obviously that that's not true. Just look at a few of the verses. Verse 21, "For then..." Matthew 24, 21, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be." We know that that's not true. I mean, the Holocaust, 6 million Jews, certainly a whole lot more destruction for the Jews than happened in AD 70. The tribulation for Christians, I mean, the martyrdoms that we've seen under Mao and Stalin and Hitler and so forth, certainly much greater than in AD 70. So we know that, that didn't take place in AD 70. In the next verse, "Except those days be shortened, there should no flesh be saved or survive." Well, you didn't wipe out everybody, all flesh on planet Earth, by bows and arrows and swords and spears. You're not even with conventional weapons of World War II. So that obviously wasn't true in AD 70. Our generation, in fact, is the only generation for which that prophecy makes sense. We have the weapons today to wipe out all flesh. They certainly didn't have them then. Just go on and look at some other verses. Verse 27, "For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even out of the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." Well, that certainly didn't happen in AD 70. And verse 29, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light." And verse 30, "Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. All the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he'll send his angels with a sound trumpet and gather his elect from the four winds and so forth. That certainly didn't happen in AD 70. So we're going to have to throw that interpretation out, obviously. Although these people would say, we're in the millennium and Satan is locked up, in case you didn't know it. And the church is in the process of taking over the world. That's obviously not true. Well, then there are others who said, well, that generation, in fact, I have a Scofield Bible that somebody gave me. Not that I'm a follower of Scofield, but it was graciously given to me. And he gives his interpretation. He says the Greek, genea, the primary definition of which is race, kind, family, stock, breed. So it means that the Jews, the nation or family of Israel, will be preserved until all of these things have been fulfilled. Well, that's a tautology to say that. That's, that's like saying, well, the Jews will be preserved till the fulfillment of all the prophecies pertaining to the Jews. Well, obviously they would have to be. That's not what it's saying. Then there are others who said, as I mentioned, what it means is that generation that would see Israel back in her land. Well, how long is a generation? We're way past the 40s. We're in the 50 years now. If you deduct the 7-year tribulation and so forth, I never have believed any of those. I think it's clear what Jesus is saying. And maybe, I don't expect you all to agree with me, but I don't know any other interpretation that's biblical. Jesus talked in many other places. In Matthew 12:44, Luke 3:7 and 34, Matthew 23:33, and well, that's close enough to look back and you can see it. Ye serpents, ye generation of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of hell? Matthew 16:4, he talked about a disobedient, rebellious, a wicked generation. He talked about a gainsaying, a perverse generation, a generation that would not believe, a generation of unbelievers, a generation of rebels. And I believe he's saying that Israel will continue to be in that condition until all these things are fulfilled. And of course, that's what the Bible tells us in Zechariah chapter 12. It says that it is only in the midst of Armageddon, when Jerusalem, Israel, is in the process of being destroyed by all the armies of the world who have gathered together against her, that they will look on me, Yahweh, Jehovah says, whom they have pierced, and they will mourn because of him. I and he are one and the same. A resurrected, glorified man who was pierced to the death appears as Jehovah, their Lord, and their Messiah, and they recognize him at last. But Israel will be in unbelief until that very moment. And then all Israel will be saved and they will mourn. And I think that's what Jesus was talking about. We're not to expect a great move of God and the blinders coming off the eyes of Israel and all Israel turns to their Messiah. I mean, some of the most exciting times that I've ever had is going to Israel with a group of young people, sleeping in our sleeping bags, witnessing to the Jewish people on the beaches and in the streets, and setting up a film on the streets, in various towns in Israel, and playing volleyball on the beaches and getting in contact with some of the Jewish people, which reminds me, I've got to contact a man from Israel that I met on the beach there who's living in Toronto right now. We're not gonna win Israel. We can win individuals, but all Israel will be saved. Whoever endures to the end will be saved, Jesus said at that time. So I don't know when Christ will return. There's no limitation upon it, no time period of time after 1948 until he returns. Now, there are other confusions about this, and I must stop talking and let you ask whatever questions you may have. I believe in a pre-tribulation rapture.
I believe that this is the key event that fits the pieces of the puzzle together, and without it, it doesn't make sense. You have to have a pre-tribulation rapture for a lot of reasons. One reason is you can't have the church on this earth with the Antichrist, for several reasons. If the church, the true church, was on this earth, we would oppose and expose him. That's not going to happen. He's going to be embraced by everybody, including the Jews. In John 5, Jesus said, "I am come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive." There's one coming whom they will receive. But he can only come in his time. It's very interesting. There's a timing, and the relationship between Christ and the Antichrist is very clear in Scripture. It's Galatians 4:44, is it? Or where is it? Galatians 4, somewhere around there. I don't think there are 44 verses in Galatians 4. But anyway, it says when the fullness of, Galatians 4:4 it must be, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, right? But it also talks about the timing for the Antichrist. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 6, you know what withholdeth that he should be revealed in his time. Okay? I remember being raised in a brethren assembly, and the preachers would come. They all stayed in our home, and they came with their charts and so forth. There were two things they talked about in those days in the late 30s. Israel would be back in her land. We've seen that happen. Incredible. I mean, my grandmother was, my father's side was from Norway, so I'm 25% Norwegian. My father was from Hull, England. My mother came from London, Ontario. She was Scotch, Irish, and who knows what all, French and German mixed in there. I mean, I'm a mongrel, a mixture of all kinds of races. But that the Jews could be separated 2,500 years since the Babylonian captivity, since they've really had that land, they've been scattered all across this earth, and that they could remain an ethnically identifiable nationality of people. And not only that, that they could recover their land, be brought back there in spite of all the efforts of the world to prevent it. I mean, that's a miracle. That's one of the greatest evidences of the existence of God, and that the Bible is His Word, and that these are His people. And so they talked about that, and we saw it happen. Amazing. You couldn't have gotten the United Nations to vote on that at any other time. It was a miracle of God. But they talked about something else. The revival of the Roman Empire. Oh, that's interesting. Well, there are a lot of reasons why the Roman Empire had to be revived. You remember in Daniel 2? Maybe it's verse 44 there. I can't remember. I don't try to remember verses where they are. But it says, you know, the image with the 10 toes? And what does it say? It says, in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that will not be destroyed. Okay? That didn't happen the first time Jesus came. That's why we know that the 10 toes pertain to a revival of this system. A little later on, is it Daniel 7 or 8 or 9? I can't remember. But he says, the people of the prince who will come will destroy the sanctuary and the city. Who did it? The Romans in AD 70. So we know that the Roman Empire has to be revived, because out of it will come the coming prince. You know, Sir Robert Anderson, way back there, his book, The Coming Prince. Out of it will come the Antichrist. Okay? Now, we also know that Christ can't return until the Antichrist is on this earth, right? What does it say in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 8, 9, and 10? It says, talks about this one whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders and all deceivableness of unrighteousness, and them that believe, receive not the love of the truth, and so forth. And what does it say? Whom the Lord will destroy with the brightness of His coming. Okay? Well, then Christ the second coming won't occur until the Antichrist is here, right? Because part of the purpose is to destroy him with the brightness of his coming. Furthermore, he's not coming back until Jerusalem is surrounded by the armies of the world in the process of being destroyed, because he comes to rescue Israel. Okay, so there is a sense of timing in Scripture, and we could give other verses. There's a symbiotic relationship, you might say, between Christ and Antichrist. and they're heading for final conflict. The climax of this battle between God and Satan that has swept across the galaxies, we don't know for how long and where and what has been involved, but we know it's centered in planet Earth now, and we know that we are involved. And we're seeing the fulfillment of these prophecies. But now we must distinguish between the second coming and the rapture. Right? You biblical scholars, some of you don't agree with that. You see, as soon as you say that, there are people who say, now wait a minute, you mean there are two comings yet? You mean there's a secret coming when he's going to... Well, yes, I mean the church is not Israel. He has a plan for Israel. What did it say back there? We Christians, Gentiles, we think this whole thing belongs to us now. And we forget that at Christmas time, you remember the kings that came from the east? And you remember what they said? They went to Jerusalem, strange place for them to go. They should have gone to Montreal or Toronto or somewhere, or Washington, D.C. They went to Jerusalem. Wasn't that odd? And they said, where is he that is born king of the what? Jews! What did the angel Gabriel say when he announced the birth to Mary? That holy thing that shall be born of thee shall be called the Son of God, and upon the throne of his father David he will rule. Why, those verses that we quote, Isaiah 9, 6 and 7, unto us at Christmas time again, unto us a child is born, a son is given, the government will be upon his shoulders, his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, and of the Prince of Peace, of his kingdom and peace there will be no end, and upon the throne of his father David it will be established forever. Did that happen the first time Jesus came? No. Then you better believe it. He's coming back. What? For Israel, to fulfill his promises to his ancient people. And that has nothing to do with us, folks. See, we got a confusion in the church. I want to get back to the difference between the second coming and the rapture, but let me just read something here. I'm quoting Rick Godwin, a longtime associate of James Robison. And James Robison, if you know who he is, he believes the same thing. This is a talk he's been giving across America, and others are saying the same thing. It's a growing teaching in the church today. He says, they, national Israel, are not chosen. They are cursed. They are not blessed. They are cursed. Yes, and you hear Jerry Falwell and everybody else say, the reason America is great is because America blessed Israel. They sure have. Which Israel? The Israel. The church. That's the Israel of God, not that garlic one over on the Mediterranean Sea. That's pretty heavy anti-Semitic rhetoric coming from now from supposed Christian leaders, evangelicals, charismatics they happen to be. Across the page, I'm quoting Earl Polk, has about a 10,000-member church near Atlanta, Georgia. He says, the hour has come for us to know that the spirit of the Antichrist is now at work in the world through so-called Holy Spirit-filled teachers who say, if you bless national Israel, God will bless you. What? It says, I will bless him that blesses you and curse him that curses you. But now we have Christian leaders saying the spirit of Antichrist is to say God blesses those who bless Israel. And they're saying Israel doesn't belong in that land. And the church is Israel. James McKeever teaches this and many others. So we recently had a conference, a large gathering in Phoenix, Arizona. It was called, the title of the conference, the theme of the conference was Take It by Force. Okay? And they used a verse, a promise that God had given to Joshua. Go up and possess the land. And they said, God is raising up a Joshua generation and we're going to take over America and the world. Why, we got to take over the schools. We're going to take over the media. We're going to take over politics. We're going to get our people voted into high office. And we're going to change this world back into a Christian, this nation back to a Christian country and so forth. That's not what my Bible teaches. Jesus said, if you were of the world would love his own. But because you are not of the world, but I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. The servant isn't greater than his Lord. If they hated me, they will hate you also. Okay? But now they're saying, oh no, we're going to be voted in to to top offices. Well, now, wait a minute. Go up and possess the land? Joshua didn't have the right to take over the United States. Joshua was, that promise pertained to a very narrowly prescribed, very clearly identified, the boundaries were, of the promised land. And Joshua had no right to take over any other land. And what perversion to apply a verse given to the children of Israel that applied to a narrowly prescribed piece of real estate in the Middle East, and to take that as an excuse for the church taking over the world. So we lost our hope of heaven. And we're building our kingdoms on this earth. And in whatever happened to heaven, I go back to in history, and when it began with Constantine, who supposedly became a Christian, who really wasn't a Christian. He was the head of the pagan priesthood. Rather interesting. You remember how the Christians were persecuted under the Roman Empire in the early days? They had an image of the emperor, and if you didn't worship it, you were killed. Right? What does it say in Revelation 13? You're going to build an image to the beast, and whoever does not bow down to it will be killed. It says the beast will be worshipped as God. Oh, see, part of our problem was we thought of the Roman Empire as a political entity, an economic entity, and we forgot that it was primarily a religious entity, and the emperor was worshipped as God. He was the head of the pagan priesthood. And as the head of the pagan priesthood, he had the title Pontifex Maximus. You know who bears that title today? We just came from Rome. We saw it everywhere. Pope so-and-so, Pontifex Maximus. Pope so-and-so, Pontifex Maximus. Another one on a statue of Pontifex Maximus. Because Constantine passed that on to the popes. And when he supposedly was converted, he became the de facto head of the Christian church. So as the head of the Christian church, at the same time he was building pagan temples and presiding over the pagan priesthood, he was also presiding over Christian ceremonies. It was Constantine who called the first ecumenical council. He was the first ecumenist. The first ecumenical council, the Council of Nicaea, gave the opening address, presided over it, and so forth. For what purpose? That he cared about doctrine? No. He wanted to unite the empire. And you couldn't be united politically unless you were also united religiously. And Mr. Gorbachev knows the same thing. That's why he went to visit the Pope, hat in hand. And he said, we have changed our thinking. We are for spiritual values. And in fact, he talked about a united Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. I'm not telling you anything you haven't seen in the news. And we thought the 10 toes were just 10 nations in Western Europe. I don't believe so. The Roman Empire was much bigger than that, and they colonized and Christianized the world. They laid the foundation for a worldwide apostate Christianity, and that's what we're going to have. And Gorbachev comes and he says, we belong as part of the EEC. We're Europeans. And you know why we're Europeans? Because we're Christians, he said. And he made this statement on the 1,000th anniversary of the conversion of Vladimir. You remember how Vladimir was converted? He checked out a few religions. He checked out the Muslims, and you couldn't have alcohol, so he threw that one aside. It just happened that Eastern Orthodoxy put on a more impressive pageant than the Roman Catholics, and so he went for Eastern Orthodoxy. That was the conversion of Vladimir, okay? An apostate paganized Christianity, and that's what the Catholic Church has been. It's paganism under a thin veneer of Christianity. And the title Pontifex Maximus, Vicar of Christ, and so forth, was passed on to the popes. So this all has to be revived. The religious aspect of it has to be revived. And we're seeing that happen in our day. But getting back to what I was talking about, the difference between the second coming and the rapture. Why must it be? Well, first of all, because one is for the church and the other is for Israel. You confuse these two, take it by force. You confuse those two, you try to say the church is Israel, we've taken over. But you see, they had to do that. When the church under Constantine merged with the world, it became obsessed with building a worldly kingdom, ruling over the kings of this earth. Well, now, if the church is the earthly people, where does that leave the Jews? They're out in the cold, which is why
And we give you plenty of documentation in here, the edicts of the Catholic Church, of the popes and so forth. That is why it has been anti-Semitic from the very beginning, as is Lutheranism. Luther never escaped that. And that is why Hitler used the edicts, the pronouncements, both of Luther and of the popes against the Jews, to justify what he did to the Jews. He did nothing that the popes and Luther hadn't said should be done to the Jews. So, if the church is Israel, we got some real serious problems, prophetically. All right, now, he comes for his bride, takes her away, because we don't want, you can't have opposition to the Antichrist. Furthermore, what does it say? Revelation 13. Power is given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. But Jesus said, the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. You believe in a post-tribulation rapture, I'm sorry, you're not going to live to see it. It'd be a classic non-event, because there's not going to be any Christians left. Take the mark of the beast and worship his image, or you can't buy and sell, you'll be killed. If you do take the mark of the beast, you suffer the wrath of the Lamb. You're not a Christian at all. So there wouldn't be any Christians left to rapture at the end of the Great Tribulation. But there's got to be Christians here. Who are they? An apostate bride of the Antichrist. They call themselves Christians, and they're not real Christians. And we are filling our churches today with that kind of people who are coming to the wrong Christ on the wrong basis with a false gospel. You see, anti in Greek has two meanings. It could mean opposed to, and that's the way most people think, what most people think it means. It also means a substitute for or in the place of. The Antichrist doesn't come against Christ. He comes as Christ, pretending to be Christ. And there has to be Christian churches who hail him as the Christ. Okay? That's the apostate church. And that's why Paul said, that day cannot come until there comes this great revival. You'll hear about it on Christian television and radio and so forth. No. Until what? A great falling away, the apostasy. That must be there, because there must be an apostate bride to hail him. And you're going to have Christianity united with all the religions of the world. Well, I'm biting off more than I can chew at this point. So let's get back to this. We're gone. And then he comes for Israel. Well, now, wait a minute. Those of you that object to that, you say, show me chapter and verse in the New Testament where it says there are two phases to the second coming. I have a very simple response. You show me chapter and verse in the Old Testament where it said there were two comings. Never said it. Never said it. And that's why they were confused when Jesus came the first time. And that's why John the Baptist sent messengers saying, art thou he that should come, or look we for another? John the Baptist says, what am I doing in prison? I thought you were going to set up your kingdom, and I'm your right-hand man. I'm the one that introduced you. How come I'm about to get my head cut off? That doesn't compute. See, all they could see was the establishment of the kingdom. And that's why the two on the road to Emmaus said, we thought he was the Messiah. Well, I mean, obviously he couldn't be. I mean, they killed him. I mean, he couldn't be the Messiah. And furthermore, I mean, talk about bad news. Some of our company went to his grave and they couldn't even find his body. We don't even have a shrine to remember him by. I mean, we don't know what's happened to him. And that's why the rabbis yelled at him, if you're the Messiah, come down from the cross. And why the thieves said, if you're the Messiah, save yourself and us. And that's why in Matthew 16, when Jesus, it says, from that time forth began to show his disciples he must go to Jerusalem and be crucified. He must die. And Peter said, Lord, wait a minute. I mean, I know you're sinking into depression. You've got a bad self-image and low self-esteem, and Lord, you've become so negative. Now you got to have a positive outlook on life. Let's have a little positive self-talk. I can't do it.
get a stiff upper lip, Lord. We'll go to Jerusalem and we'll make a positive confession. Jesus says, get thee behind me, Satan. They didn't understand, no matter how many times he told them that he had to die. It didn't make sense. They were confused about the kingdom. They were confused about the cross. Same thing today. Well, how would you know there were two comings? Because even though the Old Testament didn't say it, you couldn't possibly put together in one event what the Old Testament said about the coming of the Messiah, right? Why, on the one hand, Isaiah 53 says, he will see his seed, he will prolong his days. No, Isaiah 53 says, he's cut off out of the land of the living. Oh, it says he's coming in triumph and establish a kingdom. No, it says he's going to be despised and rejected. He's going to, you know, like a lamb, be led to the slaughter. You couldn't possibly put that together in one event. But they couldn't see it. And I would suggest to you, you couldn't possibly put together in one event what the New Testament says about the return of Jesus Christ. On the one hand, it says he's coming at a time of peace and prosperity. When they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction. Oh no, it says he's coming in the middle of Armageddon. I just quoted to you from Zechariah chapter 12. He's coming in the midst of war. No, Jesus says, I'm coming at such an hour as you wouldn't think. If you sat down and looked at the conditions of the world, you'd say, I don't think he's coming now. That's when I'm coming, says Jesus. I'm going to surprise you. You better stay awake. You better understand what I've said. He's going to come at a time of great turmoil. I mean, if you're believing in a post-tribulation rapture, that's horrendous when he's coming. The world is about to be destroyed. It's been under the judgment of God. Oh no, he's coming at a time. It's like the days of Noah. So will be the days of the Son of Man. Last thing they expected was judgment. Oh no, no, he's coming in the midst of judgment. No, no. He's coming when the last thing you would expect was judgment. In fact, he's coming at a time it's going to be so secure on this earth that not just the five foolish virgins, but the five wise as well will slumber and sleep. As the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. I don't think you can put that at the end of the Great Tribulation. He's going to come to the Mount of Olives. He's going to come to this earth like lightning, and every eye will see him, and the Mount of Olives will split, and he comes to rescue his people. Oh, no, no. Paul says, we're going to be caught up. We're going to meet him in the air. And Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go, I'm going to come again and receive you unto myself. You can't put that together with coming to the Mount of Olives and rescuing his people Israel. So all I'm saying is, you can't put into one event or into one time frame what the New Testament says about the return of Jesus Christ. He's going to come for his bride. He's got a separate plan for her. She's going to be with him in glory. You read about it, Revelation 19. Then we come with him with the armies of heaven. And we're going to reign over this kingdom that he's going to establish. Unfortunately, the church has become obsessed with building its earthly kingdoms. It just makes me shudder as I travel around and the pastor says, and you know, we got a 10-year building program, and this is going to, you know, and they're talking about their plans years ahead. It doesn't sound like they're expecting Jesus to return. Big talk now in the church. 1990s, the decade of evangelism, and we're going to, by the year 2000, we're going to present to Christ a world more Christian, you know, than not, and so forth. Hey, I don't think we're going to be around in the year 2000. What about the expectancy of the imminent return of Christ? And that was the hope of the early church. And that was really their motivation to holiness and to godliness. John said, every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself even as he is pure. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 around verse 10, it says, Paul says, I know that you're Christians because you turn to God from idols to serve the living and the true God, and what? And to wait for his Son from heaven. Now wait a minute, you don't go down to the airport in Toronto and wait for Aunt Jane tomorrow when she wrote to you and said she's coming at Christmas time. If they were waiting for him, they must have expected him. Not at the end of some 7-year tribulation, not at the end of a millennium. They must have expected him imminently. And that hope motivates you like nothing else can motivate you. Oh, you say, well, just realizing that life is short and we're going to die. Yeah, we're radically contingent beings. But, you know, maybe we could go to a high-fiber diet, or you could, you know, cut fat out, or
get an operation or something. You know, we might add a month or 6 months or something. When Jesus comes, now you got no control over this. We have a feeling we have a little control, even though we realize we could die at any moment. But the rapture, that motivates you far beyond anything that death could motivate you. Furthermore, death is something we don't like to think about. The rapture is a hope. We can have our affections set upon this, as Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, which I guess you get to this evening. Unto them that look for Him shall He appear the second time without sin unto salvation, Hebrews chapter 9. What are you doing looking for Him if He's not coming until, you know, well, He can't come until the Antichrist is revealed, because He comes to destroy the Antichrist. So we're not looking for Jesus, we're looking for the Antichrist. Somebody says every time I identify Him, somebody ups and shoots Him or something, you know. No, how could we be looking for Christ if He's not coming until after the Antichrist? You know what withholdeth that He should be revealed in His time. We've got to be taken out of the way. We're hindering this process. And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord will destroy with the brightness of His coming. So I would just encourage you to get into the Word of God and see that this indeed was the hope of the early church. And it motivated them to Christian living. Even death, you know, doesn't cut you off completely. After all, my books will still be selling, hopefully. So you still have a stake in this life. Family business will be going on. Family house will be there. Children and the grandchildren will still be around. So we still have a stake in this life. The rapture, that opens the curtain on the final drama. That cuts you off. That's finished. That changes all the rules. Everything. You're either going to heaven to be with Him, or you've been deluded into putting your hope on this earth. And that hope is of heaven. Is the hope that really cleanses our lives and motivates us to live for Him. We don't want to be ashamed before Him at His coming, but we want to be found in Him. So, whatever happened to heaven? How come we don't think about it? I'll just leave you with a challenge for the next chapter you're going to get into. You know, in verse 5, I think it is. Don't turn to it, but it says, mortify your deeds which are your members which are upon this earth. And then in verse 12, I think it says, put on as the elect of God, holy and beloved. I left out a word. It says, mortify, therefore. It says, put on, therefore. And what does therefore refer to? To what went before. And what went before? Since you then are risen with Christ, seek those things that are above, where Christ sitteth at the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on this earth, for you are dead. And your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with Him in glory. Mortify, therefore, the deeds of the body and your members which are upon this earth. Put on, therefore. This is the secret, the hope. And it really empowers us and motivates us to live as Christ would have us live. So whatever happened to heaven, I think we need to get back to that hope. Okay, questions?